Offerings for Jesus, Commentary for the January 28, 2023 Sabbath School Lesson by Stephen Terry, Director, Stillwaters Ministry, www.visitstillwaters.com. When the Son of Man comes in His glory, and all the angels with Him, He will sit on His glorious throne. All the nations will be gathered before Him, and He will separate the people one from another, as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on His right and the goats on His left. Then the King will say to those on His right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me." Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothed you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?" The King will reply, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me." Then he will say to those on his left, "Depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not invite me in. I needed clothes, and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison, and you did not look after me." They also will answer, "Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty, or a stranger or needing clothes, or sick or in prison, and did not help you?" He will reply, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me." Matthew 25, verses 31 through 45. This week we move from the tithe contract to the idea of voluntary offerings. But the voluntary aspect again comes into question when the result of not voluntarily giving your money to the church results in curses and loss. How much free will is in that process? We are not told that we were created to be loving and kind. Instead, we are threatened with eternal punishment if we are not. While this may seem perfectly normal for a human despot, does it really harmonize with God as love in 1 John 4:8? Is love to be motivated by fear, or should it arise naturally from a grateful heart, sated with blessings and comfortable in the arms of compassion and grace? We are used to being forced by governments to pay taxes or forfeit all we have. Do we then think this is how God relates to us? Does He say to us that we had money, we didn't hand it over, so He will teach us with a rod how to obey? We can hardly argue against the effectiveness of such fear-based compliance. The millions upon millions of dollars that have flowed through our own denomination's coffers is proof that such demands work, even if how they are used is questionable. We use euphemisms to disguise the actual purpose and effectiveness of what is done with that money, even to the point of covering up actual embezzlement. We call it finishing the work so Jesus will return. The idea that we are holding up the work by not giving enough is problematic, both theologically and practically. For who has the power to restrain God, even through indolence or indifference? God will accomplish His purposes. He is God. We are told we are robbing God if we don't keep the money flowing. But we do not have the strength to rob Him. God is God. We are not. Some may feel that since God has the power to simply take all of our wealth, as was done with Job, the fact that He doesn't proves that we have free will in the matter. or with all the threats and curses, if we do not keep the shiny metal rolling in, it does not sound like a very free choice on our part. When we couple this with the thick opaqueness of what is actually done with the accumulated treasure, the idea of what is necessary to finish the work becomes muddled to the point where almost anything can qualify. For instance, the denomination decided they would distribute 1 billion hard copies of the largely plagiarized book, The Gary Controversy, by Ellen White, globally, to force the parousia. Even if those books could be printed for 25 cents each, that is still $250 million for the printing, not including mailing and distribution costs. All of this to distribute something already freely available to read online at no cost to the denomination or to the reader. It begs a question. If not pouring ever more money into the church brings curses, what does such a poor use of resources bring? Does someone, anyone, have a fiduciary responsibility to exercise competent stewardship of those funds? Or does the fact that it is for a religious purpose grant them a get-out-of-curses-free card? At the time of the Reformation, the churches had tremendous wealth, and the common folk could do little about it, as prelates exploited the gullibility of the people, pushing them to contribute anything of value that they might own to the church, and promising ephemeral blessings in return. But despite the constant flow of wealth from the destitute to the church, the lot of the people did not improve. The church only grew ever more corrupt with nepotism, simony, and profligacy. Because this was a period dominated by the Roman Catholic Church, the blame is often fixed on that denomination, as it is in The Great Controversy. Seventh-day Adventists love to point out the battles fought for reform by the likes of Martin Luther against Tetzel's sale of indulgences, as though associating themselves with that fight exonerates them from their own greed and corruption. It does not. If anything, it highlights the failings of corporate religion, including Adventism, even more. To be sure, despite our profligacy, God is love. He cares for the poor, even in opposition to our own hard-heartedness when we do not. But for every soul who sacrifices for inane projects like the Great Controversy distribution, for each one who cannot afford their medicine, an adequate diet, proper clothing, shelter from the elements, we as a denomination have denied love to and replaced it with harsh servitude to our warped agenda. While that may not be the denoted unpardonable sin, a failure to love on that scale is tragic and must certainly fall close to those precincts. I once spoke with a wealthy local elder of the church's constant desire for money for building projects and the burden this places on the members to build as though we were planning on occupying the earth for God instead of looking forward to heaven. He didn't see the problem with it. I said the poor already have so little, they cannot constantly contribute what they do not have. His response was that they can use shovels and give their labor then. His point, though I doubt he understood it that way, was the demands of the church will not cease, so everyone should harness up to finish the work. Since I have mentioned it several times now, what does that phrase, finishing the work, mean? As defined by many within the denomination, it means striving to become spiritually perfect in order to be able to stand without Christ as an intercessor during a period of judgment prior to the parousia. While this idea has been challenged repeatedly within the church, we always seem to gravitate back to it. It arose as a response to the great disappointment of 1844, to reconcile repeated failed date setting for the coming of Jesus with the reality that he did not come. The shame and distress of that caused the founders to consider their own reputations before the people more than the implications of the theology they were creating. As a result, they crafted a poison pill theology that prevents the church from ever recognizing that Christ accomplished a completed work of grace 2 millennia ago. This is the true tragedy concerning the never-ending demanding for more and more wealth to finish the work. The work has already been sabotaged almost from the beginning in the mid-19th century. It cannot be completed because of that sabotage, and we are the ones to blame. So instead, we go through the motions of finishing the work, but are building ecclesiastical kingdoms here on earth. We have become the image to the very denomination we have excoriated for their corruption. We have no clearer idea of how to translate earthly ecclesiastical power and glory to the heavenly than they did. We create fantastical prophetic charts with horrendous symbols and beasts, intricate timelines, and esoteric and self-serving definitions. But in the end, we accomplish nothing as far as the parousia. That is as it should be, though. It's not in our hands. We have been left as stewards in charge while the Master is away. We're to be ready for his return, though we're not told when that would be. So what are we to do? Raise money? Begin massive building projects to honor our Master while he is away? Should we gather all the resources we can for one great push to get the Master back sooner? The answer is perhaps too simple for us to be willing to accept it. We need only love one another and care for one another. Every time we take care of the church instead of one another, we fail on that point. Thank you for listening to this podcast. You can find the written version of this podcast, along with hundreds more commentaries and podcasts, at our website at www.visitstillwaters.com. May God richly bless you and your family.